her head high, breath held. If he kissed her, she would fail, would break, weep, betray herself to the children. He took her hand, helping her to her feet. In the lane, Lucy was crying, and Sarah attempted to comfort her, but impatiently.
The same old story, she told her mother. Stayed up too late.
Yes, she did.
I didn't undo my sandcastle,
Lucy roared. Hush, dear, it doesn't matter.
Goodbye, and thank you for the picnic,
the children began to say, coming one after another to shake hands with Catherine.
You should have reminded me,
shrieked Lucy at the end of her tether. Oh, Christ, said Chris. Chris, I won't have that, said Catherine. They swung onto their bicycles and began to ride away, turning often to wave.
Goodbye, Fanny. Goodbye, Sue, Chris shouted.
Sarah called once. Then she shook hands with Peter and turned towards the house, gathering up Ricky, too tired to make the next step. Goodbye, Catherine, or I shall miss the bus.
Yes. Goodbye, Peter.
Take care of yourself. And you take care of her, he said to Chris with bright jocularity as he began to walk away down the road. What, my dear old mum? Chris said, and flung his arm across her shoulder so that she staggered slightly.
Then, hearing a faint cry in the distance, he rushed from her into the middle of the road and shouted again, his hands cupped to his mouth.
Goodbye! Goodbye!
Amanda Root was reading Goodbye, Goodbye by Elizabeth Taylor. It was abridged and produced by Justine Willett. And this is Petrock Trelawney with you on Radio 3 from the BBC Proms, where the concert will continue shortly this Monday night with Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra. The players of the Philharmonia Orchestra back on stage. They're conducted this evening by Susanna Malki, one of that vital group of Finnish musicians to be found these days. The conductor's rostrums of the world. Malki is music director of Ensemble Intercontemporain, the celebrated Paris-based new music orchestra founded by Pierre Boulez. I asked her about her love of the new.
I think it's really fascinating today to see the whole field of contemporary music, because there are so many things going on, very, very many different styles. The old-fashioned modernism and things like this, the dogmatic time, is more or less over, and composers can permit themselves to do all kinds of things, which is, I think, a positive thing. And it's really fascinating to be in contact with them. And also, I think this variety reflects our time, because now we have all fusion culture, all the elements are mixing, and music reflects this also. It's very, very inspiring.
We're going to hear you conducting Bartok next, his Concerto for Orchestra, which he wrote in America. It was the work that helped him find his voice in America. It was commissioned by an American orchestra. He wrote it in the Adirondack Mountains. And yet it is still very Hungarian, isn't it, in its influence in the folk song that inspired Bartok throughout his composing career.
Yes, it's an extraordinary piece. I mean, Bartok is a genius for me, one of the most important composers of the 20th century. He's very original. He was very much ahead of his time. I think in the early 20th century he wrote pieces which were really modern. And actually the Concerto for Orchestra is quite interesting as an example, because it's more traditional than the earlier pieces. And it's his most famous piece. It's really virtuosic for the orchestra. And as you say, it has a lot of the folksy elements, and it's also extremely dark. It ends with victorious mood, but it has some incredibly profound moments.
Susanna Malki talking to me earlier. Well, Jolt Tihama Vicente, leader of the Philharmonia Orchestra, just concluding tuning on the platform here at the Royal Albert Hall. And here comes Susanna Malki to conduct the orchestra here at the Proms in Béla Bartók's Concerto for Orchestra.
Thank you.
The Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Susanna Malki. Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra. The work that got Bartok going again, he found himself stuck in exile in New York in 1939. Poor health with financial difficulties and deeply missing home, found it very difficult to compose, been ripped away from the culture that had inspired and fed him. Then Koussevitzky commissioned a major work for orchestra, for the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Bartok went off to the Adirondacks and wrote the Concerto for Orchestra. The bassoons of the Philharmonia Orchestra on their feet, soloists from the rest of the woodwind section, the whole of the woodwind section standing now. The work premiered in December 1944, the last time that Bartok was seen in public. He died the following year. That cheer for the brass, Christian Baraclough, principal trumpet, Lindsay Schilling, principal trombone, Peter Smith playing tuba. Now the strings on their feet as well, the whole orchestra standing. Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra, as I say, premiered in 1944. It was the following year that Walter Legg founded the Philharmonia Orchestra. Initially as a recording orchestra, soon though became one of the stalwarts of live music making in London. Susanna Malki, Finnish conductor this evening, returns once again to the platform. Shakes hands with the leader, blows kisses to the orchestra, and brings them once again to their feet. And I think with the cheers going strong after that performance of Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra, trying to bid you a good night from us here at the Royal Albert Hall, hand you back to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House.
Petrok, thank you very much. Petrok Trelawney there at the Royal Albert Hall. The Philharmonia playing at that Bartok especially, full of life, colour and with a diamond-cut precision and clarity. The clarity a credit to the musicians, of course, but also to the BBC's own senior balance engineer this evening, Susan Thomas. And as well as the iPlayer online, there's a chance to hear tonight's prom broadcast again here on Radio 3 on Sunday the 26th of August at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Also, if you want to find out more about Olga Neuwirth, the composer of tonight's viola concerto, she's the subject of tonight's prom's composer portrait at 9:45. Well, we're back live at the hall for our next prom tomorrow night. Delius, Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony and Saint-Saëns Second Piano Concerto. The soloist there, Benjamin Grosvenor. Charles Dutoit conducts the Royal Philharmonic, and that's live here on Radio 3 at the earlier time of 7 o'clock tomorrow night. The Delius, by the way, at the start of the concert, is Paris, the Song of a Great City, music Delius wrote a few years after his decade living in Paris and using a Richard Strauss-sized orchestra to evoke a dusk-to-dawn merry-go-round of the city's nightlife. The sheer energy of the piece comes as quite a surprise if you only know Delius from his summer pastorals. Speaking of energy, few had more of it than Delius's friend Percy Grainger, one of whose more amazing stunts was to throw a tennis ball over the roof of the Delius house, run through the house and catch it as it came down on the other side. None of which has much bearing on this music, except some 25 years earlier, Grainger was in Lincolnshire, noting down a local singer singing this folk song. Never mind the singer couldn't remember anything beyond the first verse of the song. It seems it was the Australian-born Percy Grainger who was responsible for this most English of songs passing into a wider consciousness, especially into Delius's consciousness.
It was on the 5th of August, the weather fine and fair. Thinking that
The English folk song Brig Fair, as arranged by Percy Grainger, the tenor there, Peter Piers, and the choir with Grainger's harmonies, the Linden Singers, conducted by Stuart Bedford. When Delius first heard that, as Grainger put it, he fell in love with my setting and at once asked my permission to use the tune in a more spun-out form, and the result was a set of variations on the folk song, what Delius himself called a rhapsody. Well, Grainger himself is the subject of the essay this week in the Radio 3 Evenings. He travelled all around Britain with a phonograph recording rural folk singers. And tonight's essay explores Grainger's passion for folk song. That's the essay here on Radio 3 at 10:45 tonight. But before tonight's composer portrait on Olga Neuwirth, some relatively rare Delius, and perhaps a pity it should be. Plenty of rarely heard Delius pieces in this year's proms, of course, but not this one. Delius here in Scotland, Delius the climber of mountains, an inveterate walker generally, here musing on nature and its mysteries with harmonies only he knew how to devise while lying atop a mountain in Invernessshire. This is Delius's On Craig Dhu.
Thank you.
Odysseus's On Craig Dhu. The Elysian Singers there, conducted by Matthew Greenall. This is BBC Radio 3. Well, you may have heard Olga Neuwirth's viola concerto in this evening's prom, and she was the subject of a composer portrait at the Royal College of Music earlier this evening, presented by Andrew McGregor.
Welcome to this Proms Composer Portrait, where we're about to hear young musicians from the Royal Academy of Music in London tackling what might be two of the most demanding scores they've been asked to prepare, which they've been rehearsing this afternoon with the woman who created the viola concerto that's given its UK premiere in the evening's prom, Austrian composer Olga Neuwirth. And now, Olga, the two chamber works we're hearing are from 1999 and 2005. So how do you react to working on preparing and hearing some of your earlier music on an occasion like this?
First, I feel old. and on the other hand, it's kind of strange to get in a lost country because it's long ago. And you have to re-find what you were thinking or what were your aims at this time. So the first piece I've written when I lived in Venice, and I think it was very influential for me, and I wrote a lot of pieces when I was in Venice. And the second piece is much kind of later, it's like 6 years later, and I was on another trip, and you will be able to hear that. And for me, then it's hard to find a way again on my trip, my own trip. It's like when you go back to a city where you haven't been for a long time.
You expect a lot from your players. You use a lot of what some people call extended techniques. You take particular aspects of the instrument and particular sounds that it can make, which are away from classical tradition, and you often have to kind of teach the players to learn what you want them to do with their instruments?
Well, I think in these two pieces I'm kind of friendly. I have much pieces which I have to much more kind of explain. This was an area where I tried to become more traditional, to go back to some traditions and also quote, for example, as I told, Messiaen in the second piece. But it's actually also always very challenging. It's very nice to explore with musician a new land. And I think composing is like being an adventurer. So I think it's also, I like to play with the unknown, and I hope that somebody follows me.
But listening to some of your music, and not just these pieces that we're going to hear, I can't help feeling that somehow I'm getting hints of some of the things you've done with electronics, and you may be trying to reach some of the same sounds and experiences and ideas that you've been able to create at IRCAM in Paris, for example, and finding ways of actually exploring with more traditional instruments similar kind of territory. Would I be right with that?
Yes, you are very right with that. Because I was very, at the beginning, immediately, I worked a lot with electronics. So for me, the treatment of the traditional instruments so they become something else was very important for me. So that not to stick only to instruments which are finished, you know, in the 19th century. And I'm a composer at the end of the 20th century, now and even already in the 21st century. So I thought electronics was always important. So, but I always love traditional instruments. So I thought, how is it possible to create different kind of sounds which could sound like electronics if I play around a little bit with them or distort them or detune them so it could create some kind of fake electronic sounds.
We're going to hear elements of all of those things in the pieces that are being played for us in this composer portrait. But so you expect quite a lot of the players and you extend them into areas that are perhaps not familiar to them. What about us? What about the audience? What do you expect from us? What do you expect us to bring?
Well, I don't want to force anybody, but if somebody is open, this is the most important thing. So if you don't have petrified brains, then it's open for everything.
Well, let's explore the first piece we're going to hear. It's Ad Auras in Memoriam H. Now, tell us something about the dedication.
Well, as the title says, In Memoriam is an In Memoriam piece. So it was written for a friend, important friend who died very early, especially when I lived in Venice and I couldn't say goodbye. So this piece is a goodbye, an addio, so after the death. And this is the H, that's why the first letter for the name. And I refer a lot to the sound, the note of the B. And I was playing around with the B. So the B is detuned, so the B becomes a whole world. And the other thing is because I lived in Venice and I like to go on the Laguna, and so there's this incredible silence sometimes, and there is no breeze, and you only hear air and very, very soft changes of colors of the calm sea. So you can, we will be able to hear that. And then there are little kind of like somebody tries to get life again. And there are some, there are patterns which come back and overlap each other. So they try to find one line, but they will never have one line because they are also out of tune. So trying to be together at the same, you're always separated.
So that explains the tuning. You've got the first violin tuned down about a third of a tone. And so you get that never quite perfect unisons, even when they're playing very close together. And a lot of very ghostly spectral sounds, the harmonics, the glissandi, the flautando bowings, all of those kinds of techniques. But we also have on stage a wooden drum, and this isn't any kind of off-the-shelf instrument. It's a cube. It's specifically 43 centimetres by 43 centimetres. Why? Is this from a particular tradition? Is there some historical reference here?
No, I was trying it because these airy sounds of the and the ethereal sounds of the two strings, I wanted to have this cut, something is cut off, like life is cut off all of a sudden. And this wood has this, actually it has no real resonance, and it has doesn't have a real beautiful sound, like a traditional drum with skin. So if you hit it, it has always this crackling sound. So it's like also the rhythm is very not very complicated. It's like a conduct if you are on a march, and what is Trauermarsch?
A funeral march.
It's a funeral march. So this is kind of the reference to yes, a funeral march.
Well, let's hear it. To perform Ad Aris in Memoriam H by Olga Neuwirth, please welcome violinists Min Majo and Cassandra Hamilton and percussionist James Crook, and two page turners for the string players as well. Ad Auras to the Light, In Memoriam H, written by Olga Neuwirth in 1999, performed by musicians from the Royal Academy of Music, violinists Min Majo and Cassandra Hamilton, and the wooden drum played by James Crook. Now, Olga, In Memoriam, music and memory, and, well, the sounds and ideas in classical music and tradition that surround us, you seem to like to find the cracks in some of those ideas and explore our attitudes to tradition in uncomfortable ways.
Uncomfortable or uncomfortable?
Uncomfortable.
First, I really would like to thank the musicians because it's really amazing how these young people, it seems like it's very easy to play this music. So this is really important, I want to say that. Well, I'm kind of haunted and obsessed by memory and what the brain does to us. Since I'm a child, we have a lot of problems with brains in our family and what brains can produce. Maybe even that's why I'm a composer, is also, I think, a brain damage somehow, I have to say. Who wants to become a composer nowadays in the 21st century? But the interesting thing is, what does recollection to us? It's fake recollection. We think it's recollection. It's distorted recollections and shortened recollections, and they pop up and they are triggered by something you don't even know. So this is what I always like to do in my music. All of a sudden something comes from somewhere you don't know, expect it, like the wind brings something to it, or even the brain kind of pops something up you wouldn't expect. So sometimes like, oh my God, what is she doing? Where does that come from now? And then it's gone again. So you're like, ooh, where is it?
So are you using these ideas consciously as triggers to see what they make happen in a listener's mind, or is it more controlled than that? You don't want that sort of random effect. It's you articulating something of your own.
Yes, I'm constructing it, but it's like experiences I have with my own brain, let's say, because I went to, you know, like for example, Oliver Sacks, and I really did brain my own brain waves to see what happens while I'm composing. It's very interesting when you do whatever you do, what part of the brains, also, for example, are densified or are stronger activated. This is what I really always like to do in my compositions, is like play with this and play with different kind of materials, very heterogeneous, but they all kind of come together to a synthesis, which is, of course, isn't a synthesis, but it's like the brain is a labyrinth, so everything kind of my music is a labyrinth. And sometimes there's a lot of things going on at the same time and you don't know where to listen to. So my obsession is, what does the brain do us, and especially also to a composer, because in music, the timeline only goes in one direction. There is no going past, back. Like in films, you have this wonderful thing that you make a recollection through just taking a material and pretend that it had happened. But with us, it's not possible. So when we are repeating something, it's a fake recollection.
But you quote other composers or use other composers' music in your pieces. I was thinking of a piece called No More, where you take fragments and samples of composers going back in history and have a sort of compressed history of music going on alongside a live ensemble. So surely you're doing something of the same kind yourself there, aren't you?
Yes, because that's my brain. There's too much at the same time.
So we're actually seeing the process in front of us.
Yes, kind of. It's a picture, which is not a picture. It's a sound picture.
But then with the trumpet concerto, which you wrote as well, there are allusions to various things in trumpet history, aren't there? You get sort of from Mahler to Miles Davis all in the course of this one piece. Again, not quite directly quoted a lot of the time, but you feel the flavour and the intensity of those areas of music.
Yes, it's more like illusions. I really like to give illusions. But especially with the trumpet concerto, it's my own history. I was a trumpet player and I lost my trumpet because of an accident that I will never be able to play the trumpet anymore. So I gave this poor trumpet player everything I wanted to do ever. So, and the different kind of repertoire I was playing. So everything is kind of there and not there anymore because it's fragmented.
Well, we're going to hear the next piece in a few minutes. We're going to hear Marcius II, but I suppose you ought to tell us a little bit about the first Marcius piece, which was a solo piano piece, before we hear this.
Well, I wasn't satisfied with a solo piano. I'm not so into solo instruments with nothing around. I think it's kind of naked, and I'm more interested in creating bigger sounds. so that you don't know anymore which instrument is which and you can't distinct anymore who is who. And that's why I also sometimes like to do this detuning. So Marcius too is kind of an orchestration of the piano part. And Marcius was this poor Greek half-god who was a wonderful artist, but dared to challenge God, Apollon, to compete with him playing instruments. And of course, this is not allowed. So he went too far, and because of this hybris, of this arrogance, which the god means with an arrogance, he was playing better than the god. He was punished, and he was killed, and his skin was torn from him, and the blood went into a river. And so I was very intrigued by this whole picture of what is an artist, how do you challenge power as an artist? Do you kind of go too far, or not far enough? Or at in the end, everything becomes like a river. And as I'm so intrigued by water, I thought this is a wonderful picture that an artist, if he dies, becomes a water.
Now, to what extent is the competition between Marcius and Apollo depicted? Because you do have your wind player.
Yes.
Marcius, he played the aulos, which is a reed instrument, but you have the flute. Is this a warning to flautists?
Well, good. The aulos was a double reed instrument, and so I think he's something in between. Maybe he will survive. But the thing is, actually, so what triggered my imagination was that the god is just playing not very sensitive and not very creative, but he had like the biggest skills, let's say. So this music is kind of very mechanical. We can recognize very mechanical music, and it gets harsher and harsher. And the other way, as a contrast, you have trying to gestures of passion, of the mixture as from having technique, but also the knowledge of convey something about human beings. I mean, Weisheit, I don't know what the English word is. So you have sensitivity and skills. Mm. So this is what you can be able to hear. It's always between these kind of two worlds, kind of fight between two worlds.
Now, when you were talking earlier, you mentioned Olivier Messiaen, as though there was a quotation. Now, we can hear that there are some sounds near the beginning of the piece which are quite like Messiaen. Is it actually, is there a quotation here from Messiaen?
No, as I always do, it's a fake quotation.
And why?
It's an illusion, because I wanted to trigger this kind of sometimes, this beautiful, erratic, floating sound world of Messiaen. You don't know where it's going to, but it's really very beautiful, and the timbre is very rich. So I wanted to have this kind of, like, opening curtain to what is going to happen then.
Well, let's get our players on stage, and if we've got a moment, I'd just like to get the flautist Thomas to show us one or two of the things that Olga asks him to do in the score. So let's get them on stage. Flautist Thomas Hancox, viola player Richard Waters, cellist Pei Ji-ung, and pianist Daniel Leipart. Now, Richard and Paige are playing Scudatura. They've retuned their strings very much in the way that one of the violinists did in the first piece. And this time, one's gone up, one's gone down, so there's actually a bigger gap, about two-thirds of a tone. Now, Thomas, there are, eight special instructions from Olga. Let's have alternating harmonics. This is a trill between flageolet tones with a ground note. And you're asked to do a tongue ram, sounds a major seventh lower. And finally, let's have, this is, it looks like a sort of tone clap.